evening, and welcome to Thinking Out Loud. Tonight on our show, part two of our interview with MU Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton and Karen Lofton. Tonight we discuss a major decision that affected both Lofton's last school, Texas A&M, and the University of Missouri in the last few years. In fact, it was a decision so important that Bowen Lofton wrote a book about it, leaving the Big 12 Conference for the SEC.
I think that it's very difficult for any school like Missouri or Texas A&M to make a change that destroys a very, very deep rivalry that goes back 100-plus years.
Part two of our visit with Bowen and Karen Lofton. It's next, Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. Our guests are Bowen Lofton, Karen Lofton, the Chancellor and First Lady here at the University of Missouri. It's Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. We want to get next into a decision that was made at Texas A&M during your time there that the people here obviously can relate to exceptionally well. And it was a tough call. Texas A&M in Texas, I can remember when we had conversations. I'm a sports reporter, and so I was a big part of this whole deal when it was happening at Mizzou, and there were all these discussions about what might happen with the rest of the Big 12. And there was always this assumption, we're go with A&M, so go with UT, and vice versa. The decision to leave not just the Big 12, but UT, and break off on your own and become a part of the SEC, obviously a very big deal. I mean, heavens, you wrote a book about it. Talk a little bit about that decision and how that came to be and what a big deal it really was there in Texas and with the Aggies.
Well, it was a big deal. Leaving something where you'd been a long time was difficult, although realized the Big 12 was not that old.
Sure.
And the first part of the book that we put together, Rusty and I put together a few months ago, dealt with the background. What was it like in the 90s here as the old Southwest Conference began to break apart? And that was a key piece to understand. Clearly at that time, the people at A&M thought the SEC was a good place to go. They made an effort at it then, but the politicians in Texas, especially the two most powerful leaders there, said no, because one was a Baylor graduate, one was a Texas Tech graduate. So they kind of forced the Big Eight to become not a 10-team conference, but a 12-team conference by really forcing Texas Tech and Baylor into that mix.
Yeah.
And that set the stage for what happened more than a decade later. It was simply a matter of a conference coming together for the wrong reasons and being built around a TV contract more than around commonality in some respects. And so my first meeting of the Big 12 conference leadership was very telling. It was a civil meeting, but I mean it was clear who was in charge.
Oh yeah.
It was clear that there were haves and have-nots, and there were the seeds already there for instability were clearly evident to me. And it didn't get better. I mean, as you saw, University of Texas becoming more and more overt about their desire to test the waters of independence by building their own network while keeping all the benefits of being in the,
exactly.
in the conference,
yeah.
It became pretty obvious that they wanted to see whether they could be at Notre Dame or not. And they don't – but no risk. There's no risk involved here for them, quite frankly.
Trust me, because I was in the middle of all of this. The resentment about that was not exclusive to Texas A&M.
We all felt the same way.
Yeah.
And Commissioner Beebe was not particularly helpful, shall we say, in trying to adjudicate all that stuff. So a lot of stories are in the book. We won't go into here, obviously. But, again, understand the context of it. Then you look at how it happened. In 2010, we made an effort at A&M before Missouri had really decided, I think, where they wanted to go to make it happen then. And again, politicians and other things got in the way of that happening. But 2011, because of Texas's own approach with the network they created, the seeds of dissent were so large then that my fan base went from being divided in 2010, 50-50 at A&M between where to go to being 95-5 in 2011. It was just night and day from one year to the next because of all the things that had happened. And so it was not easy, but it was more straightforward. The problems then became Baylor. And particularly Baylor in their effort to try to derail all this because they felt they couldn't survive on their own. Look where they are today. I told Ken Starr, I said, Ken, it'll be okay. It's clearly okay now for them. Probably number five in the nation right now in the playoff list.
So. And a solid athletic department just clear across the board, not just in football at Baylor now, which wasn't always the case.
So their fears, I think, were very unfounded, as I tried to tell them at that time. And it's all worked out well. I still think the Big 12 is not a stable conference because Texas is still, I think, potentially a independent looking for a place to go. Mm-hmm. Now, Dodge is gone. Bill Powers may be gone next year as well, based on his statements. So we'll see what happens after that.
Yeah, it's a tough time at that school right now. There's a lot going on. Mm-hmm.
But back to here, I think that it's very difficult for any school like Missouri or Texas A&M to make a change that destroys a very, very deep rivalry that goes back 100-plus years. I've studied a bit about the border war, so I now understand the depth of the rivalry here between KU and Mizzou. And that's hard to do, and it's not going to be easy for us to build a rivalry around Arkansas the way we had that one, although Arkansas being a neighboring state is pretty natural for us to play against. I do predict someday we'll see a change when Coach Self decides to go someplace else or perhaps changes his mind. We may see a different attitude at Kansas. I don't think there's any fan out there who's really against this as far as I found it.
Sure. There's a part of this I want to get into with you. For Texas A&M and Missouri, this went a whole lot beyond who the Tigers play in softball or who the Aggies play in football or whatever. Talk about how these affiliations affect other parts of the campus. Because I told people at the time who were just like, you know, okay, well, we'll just see what happens, and it's a football thing. I said every chemistry lab, every English lit class, everything on campus was affected by affiliation with these other schools, whether it had anything to do with sports or not.
Well, first of all, my experience is limited, of course, to the Big 12 and the SEC from my level of administration. But the differences are like night and day. The interactions we have today with our SEC colleagues at every level are far more deep and far more varied than they ever were in the Big 12. Every administrator of consequence here gets together with common administrators from the SEC on a regular basis. Student leadership does as well. Didn't happen in the Big 12. The SECU is an effort to academically tie us together by hosting regular academic conferences around a common theme. All of us do research and teaching in those areas. Those are important binders as well. There is a sense of family in the SEC that I never sensed in the Big 12, again, possibly because of history and how things came together. So we have a lot of reasons here to say, okay, this is something that permeates all of us. The stability we have now in the SEC is unparalleled. The visibility we have is unparalleled. The brand of this university is important to all of us, important to every student, every alumnus. Every one of us benefits by having ourselves tied to a brand which is recognized and valued across the world. And the Mizzou brand has never been more valuable. We're number 19th in the country right now in the value of our licensing royalties for our art marks. Think about that.
Yeah.
Number 19 in the country among all universities of all sizes, public and private. We're number 19. And going up the right way because people love to be part of a winning team. They love identifying with a winner, whether they're part of us in terms of being a graduate or not, doesn't really necessarily matter.
There was concern when this move got made about, to use the blunt basic term, the academic reputation of the SEC. As you talk with people around the rest of the country, and this is, I'm sure, evolved somewhat with the addition of two outstanding academic schools in Mizzou and Texas A&M, what do you find people think of the Southeastern Conference from an academic standpoint?
Well, I think Commissioner Sly, when he became commissioner, had two really big goals. He wanted to change the perception of the SEC's integrity and of its academic prowess. Integrity came down to a thought. If I heard this from my coaches back at A&M, we were talking about this. They cheat. Well, I see the data now. Other conferences are actually worse than we are in some cases, much worse than we are in some cases. There is no specific pattern of loss of integrity in the SEC schools I can detect. And I think that's Commissioner Sly being extremely firm in his leadership in this area here. And so reputationally, it takes a while for perception to be changed. The reality is the SEC is a group of schools who have high integrity in terms of their of their adherence to compliance standards at the NCAA level and conference level.
And
the other side is academics.
Yeah, I have a theory about that, though. The games have changed so much. The world of sports has changed so much. There is so much money and benefit to the school to be made by doing it the right way. It almost seems stupid to me to cheat at this point. There's so much to lose and not as much to gain, and so much to gain by doing it the right way.
I think you're right, but I would say this, that there are still coaches who I think are tempted because coaches are rewarded on results and they're fired for lack of results. And I think there's always a temptation out there. So that's why I talk every single week, several times, typically my compliance officer in analytics. I pay attention to that very, very strongly.
Right.
But I believe that's happened in the SEC, and we're just letting the perception catch up with reality right now.
Yeah.
Academic, same thing. Academically, clearly they had a reputation as being a conference of low-achieving schools. Not so much anymore. Our APRs, which are standardized across the entire nation by the NCAA, are among the very best as a conference. Now, within that, we're at the very top level ourselves. Vanderbilt usually is number one in the SEC. Yeah. We're number two in the SEC. But in football, we're number one in the SEC. Think about that. We're among the top handful, top 10% in the country among all the public and privates as well. Think about that.
Yeah.
So we have that. The SEC has four, count them, AAU schools. Big 12 has three. Think about that.
Yeah.
Now, the Big 10 and the Pac-12 have more, obviously. But you're seeing greater and greater academic and research achievements at all the campuses within the SEC right now. So, again, perception is not yet caught up reality, but it will someday do so, and we're in the right place.
It seems like you had made the decision last year. You were stepping down from the administrative role at A&M. You had a tenured faculty position lined up. It looks on the surface like it maybe was the life of semi-retired old Professor Lofton that was maybe a little bit easier than being the president of the school. Was that the intention at that point, was to kind of step back a little bit and take life easy?
Well, a lot of facts went into that, but I did announce July of last year that I was going to return to the faculty. January 13th was my last day as president of Texas A&M this year. And that was the plan, and we did a lot of things. We bought a house, Karen and I, and knowing we had to move out of the president's home at Texas A&M, I began looking for lab space on campus, office space on campus, getting things kind of stacked up slowly to allow me to be able to transition, and I'd be teaching a class beginning in January, probably had this all gone about the way that that I had thought. And then the campus here reached out to me in a couple of ways. I had been contacted by the search firm earlier in the year, which they do that routinely.
Yeah.
And I knew Brady was going to retire. He had told me that personally. I hadn't thought much about it, though. But they got very serious about the communication in early October. A few days after he bought the house, as a matter of fact.
Great, thank you.
Timing wasn't good here.
It doesn't sound like it.
But it was really, and I think part of it I learned later on was driven by one individual on that committee. Nick Droege was the student representative. He was still the president at the time. Mm-hmm. I'd met him at A&M back in early 13 as part of the SEC, bringing student leaders to the campus. And we had met, and I gave a little talk to them, and apparently whatever I had said had stuck with them a bit. So he, I believe, kind of pushed me a bit within the committee here. And so they reached out and wanted to talk to me. And that began a series of conversations, beginning with video interview, first of all, from my home in College Station to coming to meet with them physically a short time later. I met through the video and this meeting with the full committee in person, both Madam Chief Justice Ann Covington from the Board of Curators and also Dean Mills from the School of Journalism here. Two contrasting personalities.
Yeah, a little bit.
But I had a good interaction with the search committee, shall we say, over a period of time. And President Wolf and I met in Washington as part of the Association of Public and Grant Universities meeting going on in Washington last fall of last year. And had a lengthy conversation about it. And that sort of led down the pathway here. I was still not at a point where I knew this is the right thing to do. But I had to think about it pretty carefully. One of my key issues was really my ability to interact with students. So by going back to my my teaching roots, shall we say, I would be having a closer tie to students, but in small numbers. Classes would be probably fairly limited. I'd be teaching mostly upper-level and graduate courses. So we're talking about probably dozens of students, yeah. A handful of my laboratory working with me directly as mentees. And I've done it a long time, but I had also done for many years interaction in the large with thousands of students. And I was kind of debating that. What do I really want to do here? And it occurred to me that I really wasn't done with this large-scale interaction. I've enjoyed that a lot. I enjoy the variety. I enjoy the ability to interface with a whole range of people at every level from all kinds of backgrounds and majors. It enriches my life immensely to do that. And so it's kind of, in a way, a self-serving thing, you might say, but that kind of grew on me. But I have to say this. Something happened here in November of last year that really made a bit of a difference. You have to appreciate Texas A&M, first of all. A&M, the east side of their stadium is primarily devoted to students.
Right.
They get 50-yard line seats at student prices, okay. And I thought that was the only place in the world that happened. So I walk into Faurot Field November of 2013. What do I see?
All the students there on that side.
And that was a sign.
Yeah.
It was a sign, literally. It was really amazing to me. I thought everybody else put them in the wedges or the end zone or way up high. And here you had Tigers Lair right behind the bench.
Right.
Doing their thing with that shirts on in that cold weather. I thought, wow, this is impressive. That was a sign that this place put students at the right level. And that was a key issue. I had the offer in my hands, and I hadn't quite closed the deal. And that was one more little nudge in the right direction, shall we say.
Little psychic hint that maybe this was the deal. Talking with the doctors, Bowen and Karen Lofton, the chancellor and first lady here at the University of Missouri, there's a lot happening at the university, a lot happening. This is an exceptionally dynamic time. And I'd heard the phrase before, but I was in a meeting with some university people recently, and we're talking about some of the changes that were going on within a particular department, and somebody used the term in reference to you, an agent of change. Get ready. There's going to be a lot happening on campus. Dr. Lofton is an agent of change. Is that a role that you accept, that you relish? Is that a fair thing to say?
I wouldn't use the words myself. I mean, certainly people can do it, and they have done it. To me, it's not a matter of change for change's sake. That's what I think people may even imply by using that term. It's almost derogatory to say agent of change, implying that you're coming here just to change things, which would be okay. The idea is to figure out what needs to be changed, if anything,
right,
and then affect the change as appropriate. Universities are not trivial things to change, first of all. Our approach is shared governance, which gives the faculty a lot of input into how we make decisions here, means you can't do things quickly oftentimes. In my 10 years now of leadership, my third campus to be in this kind of a role, I made it clear to those over me, the boards typically over me, that some things we can do quickly.
Mm-hmm.
In 1 month here, I was able to create a division of finance and appoint a CFO, which Mizzou didn't have, which kind of was a surprise to me. Usually $2.1 billion a year operations have a CFO. We didn't have one.
Yeah.
So that was an important thing to do. We got that done quickly because it wasn't something which cut at the heart of the academic enterprise. But when you begin to look at things inside the academic heart of the institution, then things are more complicated to change. You need to be consultative. You need to be able to listen. And need that people have their ability to have them put into the decisions then. That takes time. So I've tried to make it clear that we will, in fact, investigate several things. We've made changes since I've been here. I just mentioned one. A lot of things are kind of thrust on you. The whole national visibility, for example, involving Sasha Manyakori's death led us to do a lot of things here. President Wolf made some initial decisions which triggered a whole series of events that are still going on today in terms of how we handle the compliance with federal Title IX requirements, how we handle our delivery of services to our students to ensure their mental health is maintained appropriately. All those things have been going a great deal of a change here at Mizzou over the last few months. So some changes have been rather rapid here. Other changes will take longer times for us to occur. To truly change our research trajectory will be a multi-year process here. We're about doing that because it's tied to people, you see. Mm-hmm. We have to hire really good people. We have to enable those we already have here to be able to be successful. Those things all take time. And as you may well know, getting a research grant, publishing a paper is not an overnight thing. Each can take a year at least to get done. And so you have these kind of multipliers in there that really slow things down. But we are making decisions right now with input from our faculty that I think will be impactful over the longer run, which is our goal right now.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Mrs. Lofton, about your role. We made the comment about being the first lady of Mizzou because your husband's the chancellor, but there's more to it than being married to the guy that's in charge of the campus. What do you see your role as in that regard?
Well, as I like to point out to Bowen, that I am retired. And so that means that I'm happy to support activities. I attend events with him, obviously. I love sports, so I enjoy attending all the sports activities and football. I mean, I'm excited about going to Atlanta next year, next week, more so now that Mizzou is actually going to be playing.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, we're excited about that. Women's sport, I'm very supportive of. I think we need more support in women's sport. I think we need more resources to recruit good women.
People who know me well know I'm giving a thumbs up as you say that. I've been beating the drum for that one for about 25 years, but go on.
And that's why I think the an equestrian team would really be helpful in our Title IX requirements to allow more women to participate in sports. And traditionally, the equestrian women do really well. And academically also, and so I think it would be a great addition. We have the facilities. We just need somebody on campus that says, yes, I'm passionate about it like she is, and mm-hmm. I will be able to move forward on it. And I've not found that person yet, so if there's anybody
you
out
are
there.
You that person.
Retired, remember?
Thank you.
Yes. I've saved this one to the end. We had some very big issues to talk about, research and funding and conferences and finances and all of these things. But you are recognized for a style choice that I have to ask about. What is the deal with the bow ties? Where did that come from?
It's my personal brand, sir.
Okay, man.
A long time ago, this is very early in my academic career, I was a physics professor, untenured at the time, very junior, at another university. And one day, I mean, I dressed typically in slacks and open collar shirt. It was the culture of the department. No ties were worn typically, except maybe by the department chair, that sort of thing. And so I walked into the mailroom one day, and there was my box, everybody else's box too, a letter from the university president that said, henceforth, all men will wear ties when they teach class. Well, faculty hate being told what to do.
Oh, yeah. I know that very, very well.
And so I said, I'll show him. I'll wear a bow tie. Didn't even have one, okay? I went to a colleague of mine. Her name was Jean Umland. And Jean's husband, Carl, was famous for wearing bow ties. I said, Jean, can I borrow a bow tie from Carl just for tomorrow to wear, to show this man I'm not knuckling under to his edict? And so she brought me a bow tie as a gift, actually, the ugliest bow tie I've ever seen in my life, and I still have it to this day.
Oh, fantastic.
I spent 2 hours learning to tie it, and then I wore it the next day. And many things happen after that, but what you realize is that all of us ultimately market ourselves one way or the other. We must do that one way or the other. Every student should learn it while they're here. You must develop a way to market who you are for your own future. That's important. And so I began, I mean, obviously, I was marketing myself. I was trying to raise money for my research. I was trying to influence things within the service organizations I was part of. And people began to recognize me because of the bow tie. Remember me.
Uh-huh.
So I used my middle name, Bowen, as my given name. And the connection Bowen, bow tie is there, the mnemonic connection.
Right.
So I'd find I'd meet somebody one time. And a year later, I'd remember who I was. My name even. That was pretty impressive. And so it began to be kind of a thing that grew on me as a deliberate marketing tool to brand myself, literally. And it's worked pretty well. Unfortunately, today, bow ties are so common now. Even J.C. Penney sells them. Come on. Oh. When I started wearing them 40 years ago, they were not easy to find.
I bet. That wasn't a thing back in those days.
Exactly. So. They had been there in the past. In the 40s, up in the 40s and early 50s, there had been a fair amount of bow tie wearing, mostly clip-on type things among people in office spaces and so on. There are early pictures in NASA's early days where men wore black clip-on bow ties, basically, at the consoles and everything. But that had all gone away by the 70s, late 70s, when I began wearing a bow tie. And so this is something that just grew on me. There are a few of us who do it. Santa Ono, who's the president of Cincinnati, wears one. Gordon Gee, who's now in his seventh presidency, 33 years in West Virginia again now. He wears a bow tie. He has 1,000-plus bow ties, by the way.
Oh, my.
I have over 400, but I'm only 10 years in.
Well, that's what you know Dr. Gee for as well. He's another one of those. It's just the bow tie.
What I found is a very safe gift. Yes. And people give me bow ties all the time. I get several a month typically because they're safe gifts. They know I'll use it.
Well, I will never see you with one again and not remember the fact that it started as thumbing
rebellion.
Nose.
Rebellion.
Yes. I love it. That is fantastic. We want to thank you both very much. You've been really generous with your time, and we thank you a lot for coming out. Karen Lofton, Dr. Bowen Lofton, both of you, thank you a lot for your time today. It's great to talk to you.
Mm-hmm. Good to be with you.
Dear.
Thank you.
Enjoyed it.
And our thanks once again to Drs. R. Bowen and Karen Lofton for being our guests on this special Thinking Out Loud. Thanks again also to Christian Basie of the MU News Bureau and to the Office of the Chancellor. Now, if you missed part one of our conversation, or if you'd like to listen to it again or other past programs from Thinking Out Loud, just go to our website, kbia.org, and click on Programs for Thinking Out Loud. You can find our gardening segments, Farm Your Yard. Listen again to our two-part panel discussion on Title IX. Hear Trevor talking about Ultimate Frisbee, or catch a classic conversation from our archives with Richard King talking about the early days of the Blue Note Club. Again, just go to kbia.org, click on Programs for Thinking Out Loud. And remember, you can find Thinking Out Loud on Facebook and on Twitter. Just search for KBIA Thinking Out Loud. And if you enjoy a good mystery, be sure to listen in this Friday evening to catch The Ghost with the Club Foot on the Maplewood Barn Radio Theater. It's an adaptation of a short story by Robert Barr, who was a contemporary of Arthur Conan Doyle. So it's in that Sherlock Holmes style. A fun program, The Ghost with the Club Foot. That's Maplewood Barn Radio Theater. Listen in this Friday evening and every Friday at 6:30 right here on KBIA. Be sure to listen in next Tuesday evening for Thinking Out Loud. Trevor Harris will be hosting, and he's going to bring on Trey Mackler. He's a student in music here at the University of Missouri and just won a very significant prize for composing classical music. We will talk with Trey and also with Thomas McKinney and Julia Gaines of the MU School of Music. Also, another segment from Carrie in Farm Your Yard, as Carrie Hargrove will talk about prepping your garden for spring. Listen in next Tuesday evening for Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. This week's show was produced by Sam Richmond. The associate producer of Thinking Out Loud is Trevor Harris. Tune in again next Tuesday evening for another Thinking Out Loud here on KBIA. Till then, I'm Darren Hall-Wedge. Have a great evening.